As a poet, translator, editor, and essayist, Brooklyn-born Martina Spada often focuses on important issues within our society. So it's no wonder he's received one of America's most prestigious literary awards for his lifetime accomplishments, the 2018 Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize.
The greatest civil rights struggle of our time in this country, in fact, the greatest human rights struggle, is the struggle over immigrants and immigration.
Here, Martina Spada explored that subject matter through a very personal poem included in his book, The Trouble Ball, winner of 3 poetry prizes in 2012, the International Latino Book Award, the Milt Kessler Award, and the Massachusetts Book Award from the state where he now lives and teaches at Amherst. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air, and I talk with him about this book and the many elegies it contains as we sit down for the second half of his visit to the Kansas City Public Library as part of Park University's 2013 Ethnic Voices Poetry Series. But first, let's hear him read the title poem from his 2003 collection of new and selected poems, Alabanza.
The word alabanza means praise in Spanish, and 9/11 that happened in this country becomes more and more of a patriotic commemoration every year. While all of that is going on, we must try to remember that immigrants died that day too. Many of them in one restaurant called Windows on the World, and this poem is dedicated to them. Invisible in life, even more invisible in death. That's why I wrote the poem. The title of this poem also refers to the labor union to which these workers belonged. That title is Alabanza, in praise of Local 100. For the 43 members of hotel employees and restaurant employees, Local 100, working at the Windows on the World restaurant, who lost their lives in the attack on the World Trade Center. Alabanza! Praise the cook with a shaven head and a tattoo on his shoulder that said, Oye! A blue-eyed Puerto Rican with people from Fajardo, the harbor of pirates centuries ago. Praise the lighthouse in Fajardo, candle glimmering white to worship the dark saint of the sea. Alabanza! Praise the cook's yellow pirate's cap worn in the name of Roberto Clemente, his plane that flamed into the ocean loaded with cans for Nicaragua, for all the mouths chewing the ash of earthquakes. Alabanza! Praise the kitchen radio, dial clicked even before the dial on the oven so that music and Spanish rose before bread. Praise the bread. Alabanza! Praise Manhattan from 107 flights up, like Atlantis glimpsed through the windows of an ancient aquarium. Praise the great windows where immigrants from the kitchen could squint and almost see their world. Hear the chant of nations, Ecuador, Mexico, República Dominicana, Haiti, Yemen, Ghana, Bangladesh, Alabanza. Praise the kitchen in the morning where the gas burned blue on every stove and exhaust fans fired their diminutive propellers, hands cracked eggs with quick thumbs or sliced open cartons to build an altar of cans. Alabanza! Praise the busboy's music, the chime of his dishes and silverware in the tub. Alabanza! Praise the dish dog, the dishwasher who worked that morning because another dishwasher could not stop coughing or because he needed overtime to pile the sacks of rice and beans for a family floating away on some Caribbean island plagued by frogs. Alabanza! Praise the waitress who heard the radio in the kitchen and sang to herself about a man gone. Alabanza! After the thunder, wilder than thunder, after the shudder deep in the glass of the great windows, after the radio stopped singing like a tree full of terrified frogs. After night burst the dam of day and flooded the kitchen. For a time, the stoves glowed in darkness like the lighthouse in Fajardo, like a cook's soul. Soul, I say, even if the dead cannot tell us about the bristles of God's beard, because God has no face. Soul, I say, to name the smoke beings flung in constellations across the night sky of this city and cities to come. Alabanza, I say, even if God has no face. Alabanza. When the war began, from Manhattan and Kabul, two constellations of smoke rose and drifted to each other, mingling in icy air. And one said with an Afghan tongue, "Teach me to dance. We have no music here." And the other said with a Spanish tongue, "I will teach you. Music is all we have."
Alabanza, the title poem from Martina Spada's book of selected poems, 1982 to 2002. I'm Angela Elam, and I talked with the poet in fall 2013 at the Central Public Library for New Letters on the Air, produced by New Letters Magazine at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. There is so much to talk about in that. Let's begin with music, because I know that's been a big influence in your life. And when you hear a poem like that last one, by the way, we recorded that poem, I think 8 years ago, Alabanza, and you read it so differently now than you did then. And it has a very musical quality about it. Can you talk a little bit about the relationship between poetry and music for you?
I have been influenced by music in my poetry, to be sure. I'm not musically trained. Sometimes people say to me, "Oh, you must sing." And I say, "No, I couldn't carry a tune in a bucket." But I chant. The chanting in turn in an Alabanza, but in many other poems, is predicated on anaphora. That repetition, which enables me to construct my own form. I don't write in form, usually. I mean, there's a sonnet that pops out of me every now and then. Even when I do write in form, I tend to disobey many of the rules. But I do oftentimes create my own form, and I use anaphora to do it. Anaphora involves a repetition of initial words at the beginning of a phrase. So I get structure from that and also musicality from that. Whereas in Alabanza, you hear the repetition of that key word. There are other poems where there are different forms of repetition at work. In The Trouble Ball, for example, I'm using a very similar device called epistrophe. Epistrophe involves repetition of words at the end of the phrase. And in The Trouble Ball, I use that phrase over and over again at the end of each eight-line stanza.
So the repetition in there has almost like a refrain quality to it.
Yes.
Which goes on with song. You know, I was thinking some about The Trouble Ball, what struck me about this book, more so than any of the others that you've written, has a very elegiac quality to it, because you're celebrating the lives of a lot of people who have meant something to you over the years. Why so much of that in this book?
Because my friends are dying. I have reached that age. I am now 56 years old, and people of my generation will appreciate this. Once you hit 50, your friends start dropping left and right. And sometimes it's through illness. Sometimes it's self-inflicted. Sometimes it's a combination of the two. And I'm not only referring to people of my own generation, but to my friends who were elder to me. I have had, historically, many friends who were 20 and 30 years older than myself. And they keep crossing me up by dying. You know, poets are very much like preachers in the sense that when someone dies, we're called upon to make some sense of it and to console others, to deliver some words of wisdom at one memorial service after another. And after a while, taking the same approach felt very much like ramming my head into the wall. I mean, you can write an elegy, but what does that really mean? To try to console people when it comes to the inconsolable. Because I know I can't be consoled. What I found myself doing in this collection, though, is instead of simply writing the same full-on elegy that I had written before, I tried to find the moment in an individual's life that started that individual down the path to become whoever it was we loved. Abe Osheroff, for example, a friend of mine who actually volunteered with the Abraham Lincoln Brigade and went off to fight against fascism in the 1930s. This was a man who was an activist for more than 70 years. And when he died, what I ended up doing is writing a poem about the moment when he decided that he was going to dedicate his life to being an activist. He was all of 15 years old and involved preventing an eviction as part of the anti-eviction movement in New York City in the 1930s, and confronting a police officer who would end up arresting him. He knew from that point onward that he would become this person who would inspire us for decades to come. I also believe in elegies for the living. In the case of the poem for Jack Agüeros, Blessed Be the Truth Tellers, I wrote that poem just as his mind began to slip past the point where he would not recognize the events in the poem or the poet who wrote it for him. Jack's Alzheimer's is advanced. He's the first person I have known with this dreaded, devastating disease. And I made a point of visiting Jack at his home after this book came out. I brought him the book. I read him the poem. I signed it for him. I handed it to him. And then, to my amazement and my horror, he held the book as if he did not understand what the object was. It was simply a rectangle to him. This is why we have to write elegies for the living while their bodies and their minds are still with us.
Martín Espada, talking about some of the people he's honored in his book, The Trouble Ball, here on New Letters on the Air. The writing of Jack Agüeros is still available, including his short story collection, Dominoes, published by Curbstone Press, which leads to another elegy, since Curbstone was absorbed by Northwestern University Press after the 2007 death of publisher Alexander Taylor.
Sandy was another one of those fathers I've collected. He was a great friend and mentor to many poets. And a year after he died, I got a phone call from his wife, Judy Doyle, who's the co-publisher of Curbstone. And she had an unusual request. And so that's what this poem is about. The setting is Willimantic, Connecticut, a working-class town, used to be known as Thread City for the thread mills there. And one of the things that Sandy did was to establish a poet's park there in Willimantic, named after Julia de Burgos, the wonderful Puerto Rican poet. And it's called, without a trace of hyperbole, The Day We Buried You in the Park, for Sandy Taylor. And there is an epigraph. If you want me again, look for me under your boot soles, Walt Whitman. The day we buried you in the park, I couldn't say no. Your wife had a plan revealed on the phone with the hush of conspiracy. There are laws in this city against the interment of human remains in public spaces. This was the poet's park, your vision, floating like the black butterflies of cinders over the house in ruins across the street. You and Juan saw the stone steps flowing down into the circle where the poets would stand and sing one day. You and Juan saw the poets showering the air with words and the trees drinking words like water. You nailed up the sign and spread your arms to greet us at the ceremony. This could not be explained to the clerk who stamps the licenses for the burial of the dead. Juan began to cry when he saw your ashes in the wheelbarrow. I shook him by the shoulder. The neighbor who watches the park from her window was eyeing us. I handed him the shovel. We had to clamp our jaws like mobsters, stoically soiling their hands with the grit of a rival thug. Your wife poured a bag of plant food over your ashes in case the neighbor peeked too long through the hedges or the cops rolled their cruiser to a stop, bored after years of shoving drunks into the back seat. We stirred the ashes with our hands till they turned white at the wrist, and what I'd heard was true. There is bone that will not burn, bodies that refuse to become dust, the stubborn shards of a man. Ask any criminal who labors to bury the evidence. We weren't criminals. We dug the hole in the wrong place, ripped out the roots, grunted with every shovel full of rocks. We made the little grave too big, then tossed away the dirt, forgetting that we'd need to fill the hole once we dumped you in it. When I tipped the wheelbarrow, your ashes landed with a puff, drifting in the briefest of clouds over the grass, and Juan dropped to his knees, crying again, giving us away. The neighbor poked her head from the window like a chicken suspicious of the world beyond the coop. An hour after we began, I wore a mask of ash and sweat, black shoes white, like the last man in the village to hear the warning of volcano, or a miner on the first day back at work after the strike is lost, or a believer smeared with his ancestors about to wash in the great river. A woman who recognized my face stopped me as I crossed the street.
"Did you just bury something in the park?" she asked.
"Why would I do a thing like that?" I said.
The day we buried you in the park, I drove home with three scoops of your ashes in a coffee can, chock full of nuts, the heavenly coffee, their slogan emblazoned in a cloud across the New York skyline. At your desk, there was bad coffee and good poetry, but no heaven. So I will look for you under my boot soles, walking through the world, soaking up the ghosts, wherever I may go.
The Day We Buried You in the Park, from Martine Espada's book, The Trouble Ball.
What a great tribute. The way you describe things, the woman like a chicken peering out from her coop. When you're in the process of writing, are these images that you've maybe taken notes of, or does it come up when you are in the moment of writing that poem?
Well, I think in metaphors and similes. So it's a very natural vocabulary for me. I do have the capacity to retain what I see and what I hear and hold it there, and then find the words and hold the words there for as long as it takes before I have the opportunity to set them down on the page or the screen. So it's really memory functioning on those two levels. I remember what happened, I remember what I saw and what I heard, what I tasted, touched, smelled, but I also remember the words themselves. They stick in my head. And if I'm lucky, I have an opportunity to set them down before too long. I don't remember as much as I used to.
So you don't really take notes?
No, I don't take notes. And there are times when I will recognize the situation immediately as being the stuff of poetry. And other times it'll take me years and years before I realize that, well, yes, that indeed is poetry. What I think it's important to keep in mind is that our lives and the lives around us do indeed constitute the stuff of poetry. Poetry is not something that happens on Mount Olympus. It's not something that happens to the gods. Poetry is around us all the time, if only we are able to recognize it for what it is.
You know, poets often use I, but it's not necessarily themselves. But I have to ask, your poem about Isabel, is that I, you? Did you marry somebody to help them be in this country?
Yes, that's me.
In the poem, I am confessing to a crime, and I use that phrase ironically at the end of the poem because I am referring to a far greater crime, which is the crime of our mistreatment, our abuse of immigrants in this country.
For many years, I couldn't even talk about it, much less write about it, but I felt under the circumstances, in the environment we face today, that I had to tell the tale and humanize immigrants through poetry as they continue to be dehumanized all around us, and not by coincidence during another economic downturn. There's a little bit of Spanish in this poem. The word corrido refers to a Mexican ballad, narrative song. The phrase quiero ver las fotos means I want to see the pictures. I refer also to Zapata, Emiliano Zapata, the leader of the Mexican Revolution of 1910. He came from the state of Morelos, and the subject of this poem came from that same state. The poem is called Isabel's Corrido, and it's dedicated to Isabel. Francisca said, marry my sister so she can stay in the country. I had nothing else to do. I was 23 and always cold, skidding in cigarette coupon boots from lamppost to lamppost through January in Wisconsin. Francisca and Isabel washed bed sheets at the hotel, sweating in the humidity of the laundry room, conspiring in Spanish. I met her the next day. Isabel was 19, from a village where the elders spoke the language of the Aztecs. She would smile whenever the ice pellets of English clattered around her head. When the justice of the peace said, you may kiss the bride, our lips brushed for the first and only time. The borrowed ring was too small, jammed into my knuckle. There were snapshots of the wedding and champagne in plastic cups. Francisca said, the snapshots will be proof for immigration. We heard rumors of the interview. They would ask me the color of her underwear. They would ask her who rode on top. We invented answers and rehearsed our lines. We flipped through immigration forms at the kitchen table the way other couples shuffled cards for gin rummy. After every hand, I'd deal again. Isabel would say, quiero ver las fotos. She wanted to see the pictures of a wedding that happened but did not happen, her face inexplicably happy, me hoisting a green bottle dizzy after half a cup of champagne. Francisca said, she can sing corridos, songs of love and revolution from the land of Zapata. All night, Isabel sang corridos in a barroom where no one understood a word. I was the bouncer and her husband, so I hushed the squabbling drunks who blinked like tortoises in the sun. Her boyfriend and his beer cans never understood why she married me. Once he kicked the front door down and the blast shook the house as if a hand grenade detonated in the hallway. When the cops arrived, I was the translator, watching the sergeant, watching her, the inscrutable squaw from every Western he had ever seen, bare feet and long black hair. We lived behind a broken door. We lived in a city hidden from the city. When her headaches began, no one called a doctor. When she disappeared for days, no one called the police. When we rehearsed the questions for immigration, Isabel would squint and smile. Quiero ver las fotos, she would say. The interview was canceled, like a play on opening night shut down when the actors are too drunk to take the stage. After she left, I found her crayon drawing of a bluebird tacked to the bedroom wall. I left too, and did not think of Isabel again until the night Francisca called to say, your wife is dead. Something was growing in her brain. I imagined my wife, who was not my wife, who never slept beside me, sleeping in the ground, wondered if my name was carved into the cross above her head. No epitaph and no corrido, another ghost in a riot of ghosts evaporating from the skin of dead Mexicans who staggered for days without water through the desert. 30 years ago, a girl from the land of Zapata kissed me once on the lips and died with my name nailed to hers like a broken door. I kept a snapshot of the wedding. Yesterday, it washed ashore on my desk. There was a conspiracy to commit a crime. This is my confession. I'd do it again.
That's Martina Spada reading from The Trouble Ball here on New Letters on the Air. We're downtown at the Kansas City Public Library. I don't know how many people in the audience know this, but Martine used to be a tenant lawyer and would really speak out for people in the courtroom, and you've taken that now and put it in your books of poetry.
What poetry and the law, of course, have in common for me is that they both involve advocacy, speaking on behalf of those who do not have the opportunity to speak for themselves. Not that they couldn't speak for themselves, they don't get a chance to travel the country and do readings or speak to an audience on the radio. And certainly the imposition of silence is one of the ways in which this society represses whole classes of people. And mind you, I didn't invent advocacy in poetry. This is part of a literary tradition that goes back in this country to the middle of the 19th century and Walt Whitman. It was Whitman who spoke out in number 24 of Song of Myself for what he called the rights of them the others are down upon. Whitman's influence is vast. It runs both north and south. And so Whitman's greatest disciple was indeed Pablo Neruda of Chile. And it was Neruda who stood at the heights of Machu Picchu in Canto 12 and essentially said the same thing. He said, I come to speak for your dead mouths. And so I take my cues from them, and I consider myself a poet grounded in the tradition of Whitman and Neruda, but so many others too. I think of Langston Hughes or Carl Sandburg or Edgar Lee Masters. I think of the Beats, I think of Allen Ginsberg and Lawrence Ferlinghetti. I think of contemporary poets like Marge Piercy or Carolyn Forché, all of them, and many Puerto Rican poets as well, like Jack Agüeros in this country, or Clemente Sotoveles in Puerto Rico, Juan Antonio Correger, Julio de Burgos, all part of that tradition of advocacy and poetry.
And you can discover a lot of that in Martina Spada's book, The Trouble Ball. We appreciate you being here.
Muchas gracias. Thank you very much.
Martina Spada, winner of the 2018 Ruth Lilly Poetry Prize. He was recorded at the Kansas City Public Library as part of Park University's 2013 Ethnic Voices Poetry Series. Listen to the other half of this presentation, featuring poetry about his Puerto Rican father, who throws the trouble ball on the book's cover, on our website, newletters.org. Produced by New Letters Magazine at UMKC, our shows are also available as free weekly podcast. Production thanks to Stephanie Hughes, Ramona McCallum, and Jamie Walsh. I'm Angela Elam for New Letters on the Air.